guarantee that, because that couldn't happen probably for another 2 or 3 years.
Also with us here in the studio, Uri Berliner, NPR Deputy National Editor. Nice to have you with us as well.
Hi, Neil.
And this is also being played out in the context of, yes, there's the August 2nd deadline looming a couple of weeks away, but there's the November 2012 deadline looming a few months away. This is in the context of the presidential election as well. Republicans are saying we don't necessarily want to do anything to help Barack Obama reach a compromise agreement that's going to help him pose as a deficit cutter in the next election. In the meantime, you have the Republican presidential candidates, many of them out there, I think almost all of them out there, saying, don't raise the debt ceiling.
Right, right. And, you know, as Mara was saying, this is not just about the debt ceiling or the deficit. This is really, in some sense, for the flanks of both parties, this is the mother of all ideological battles about the size and scope of the federal government. And for the Republican side, the fiscal conservatives, anything that increases tax revenues, they will oppose to the death. They think it will ultimately enlarge the size of government. They hate that. And on the Democratic side, you know, for liberal Democrats, any concessions to cut Medicare, Social Security, that starts down the road of cutting a cherished program. So the politics here, even if we're talking about, Boehner and President Obama negotiating and figuring out a path, the politics are overwhelming.
Let's also go to Capitol Hill. David Wellen is there, NPR congressional correspondent. And David, good of you to be with us as well.
Hi, Neil.
And as you look at the details of this agreement and things that are going to have to actually get voted on by the Democratic majority in the Senate and the Republican majority in the House of Representatives, is the rhetoric scaling down? Normally, if there's going to be a deal, people stop screaming at each other.
They stop screaming at each other, but I am not persuaded that there is much in terms of a deal in the works at the moment. The negotiators, when they came out from the White House meeting last night, had nothing to say. That sometimes is a good sign that there is something in the works. But I think right now we are at loggerheads in these talks. And what both the Republicans and Democrats have to do is find some kind of a deal that they're going to get both Republicans and Democrats to sign on to, enough to pass this in each chamber. In the House, you have 34 Republicans who have signed a pledge that they're not going to vote to raise the debt ceiling.
Under any circumstance.
Well, unless there is a balanced budget amendment at least passed before then, that's not going to happen. It just won't happen. And that leaves the House Republicans at least 8 votes short of getting the 217 that they would need, since they're down 3 members of the House right now, to pass this. So they're going to have to get some Democrats on board. And the Democrats are saying, well, you know, we could support something, but we have to have some kind of revenue increases if we're going to vote for this. Even the most conservative Democrats are saying that. In the Senate, on the other hand, you have to get Democrats, who are 53 in that chamber, along with at least 7 Republicans to get to 60, so that the thing can't be filibustered. And so this is the challenge right now, to find something that you would get enough members of both parties to vote for and pass in both chambers.
And at the same time, you have Democrats in the House who say, why should we help Republicans pass something we disagree with, A, and B, would help us in the next election? At the same time, you have 23 Democrats who are up this in the Senate in coming a year from November, and Republicans saying we want to make the pain for them as great as possible so they will be vulnerable come Election Day.
Well, right. And in fact, Republican leader Mitch McConnell in the Senate is saying that he has some contingency plan that he may reveal by the end of this week if no deal is reached. And that may be a smaller deal that would require yet another vote to raise the debt ceiling before the 2012 election. That works for McConnell in the Senate. He has only 10 Republican seats that are up for reelection, whereas there are 23 Democratic seats, and he would like to see those Democrats have to take another tough vote before next year's election. On the other hand, in the House, Boehner does not want to see his fellow Republicans have to vote twice on raising the debt ceiling before the 2012 election. So you have a difference of interest between the two Republican leaders in this, and it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out.
The chief negotiators, though, Mara Liasson, seem to be the President of the United States and the Speaker of the House of Representatives.
Well, they were. They were the chief negotiators. Now I don't know if they're the chief negotiators. In other words, what you had was the president and the speaker forging ahead on this architecture for a grand compromise. And that was an amazing thing for 48 hours. But now you've got Eric Cantor, whose view has prevailed that this kind of deal can't pass.
We're the down number to the smaller, two Republican in the
number
House.
Two Republican in the House. Sounds like he can count votes better than Boehner. He's the one who walked out of the Biden talks, he said, because they were talking about tax increases. And you've got Mitch McConnell in the Senate, whose hand is certainly strengthened by this.
Republican leader,
who only needs to peel off 13 Democrats to stop anything in the Senate. Democrats need to peel off 7 Republicans. As Dick Durbin, the majority whip, has said, 13 is the smaller number when it comes to the Senate. Because it's easier for Republicans to get 13 Democrats than it is for Democrats to get 7 Republicans, which is really something. Republicans stay together, and there's no sense that they're going to be split in this debate. So you're down to this very difficult thing. If you want to, and let me just say something about the smaller deal, this $2 trillion deal.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a myth, because what you hear from those talks is they really didn't identify $2 trillion in cuts. They identified about $1 trillion.
Republicans said they did
identify. Yes, but Democrats say they didn't. So there's a lot of question about whether they actually had $2 trillion worth or not. And Democrats were insisting that if you're going to have a big number of spending cuts, 1.5 or something, you're going to have about $400 billion in tax increases that could be loophole closing.
Mm-hmm.
And Eric Cantor has said in the past, that's okay with us so long as there's no net tax increase. So it would have to be balanced with a tax cut, which, by the way, the president wants. The president wants a one-year extension of the employee Social Security payroll tax that he negotiated with the Republicans in December. It expires at the end of 2011. He wants another year. That would far outweigh closing the loophole for corporate jet owners or something like that. That would be fine. But it would reduce the amount of deficit reduction you get.
So there is the quandary. We're expecting the president to come out to the Brady briefing room in the White House in about a minute's time. Among the cuts, by the way, if you are interested, on which tentative agreement, nothing is final until everything's final, but tentative agreements have been reached to include cuts to farm subsidies, student aid, federal workers' pensions, domestic agency budgets, among others. There's a limited amount that can be garnered from cuts in these so-called discretionary spending areas, and it's not going to get everybody to where they're going to need to be.
You know, and the politics of this were, for a while, Democrats seemed to be putting Republicans on the defensive. They were saying, are you really going to defend to the death the tax break for corporate jet owners or oil and gas companies? We're not talking about raising anybody's rates. We're merely talking about asking some of these special interest groups to sacrifice as well as you're asking all these other people, middle class people, people who depend on farm programs or other things to also cut back. You know, there's a way to see this medium-term deal getting done, but very hard at this point.
President's due out any second now in the White House briefing room, and he'll be talking again about the deficit reduction talks that are part of this agreement. What everybody hopes is an agreement to raise the debt ceiling. Here's the president.
Good morning, everybody. I want to give a quick update on what's happening with the debt negotiations, provide my perspective, and then I'm going to take a few questions. As all of you know, I met with congressional leaders yesterday. We're going to be meeting again today, and we're going to meet every single day until we get this thing resolved. The good news is that all the leaders continue to believe, rightly, that it is not acceptable for us not to raise the debt ceiling and to allow the U.S. government to default. We cannot threaten the United States' full faith and credit for the first time in our history. We still have a lot of work to do, though, to get this problem solved. And so let me just make a couple of points. First of all of us agree that we should use this opportunity to do something meaningful on debt and deficits. And the reports that have been out there have been largely accurate that Speaker Boehner and myself had been in a series of conversations about doing the biggest deal possible so that we could actually resolve our debt and our deficit challenge for a long stretch of time. And I want to say I appreciate Speaker Boehner's good faith efforts on that front. What I emphasized to the broader group of congressional leaders yesterday is Now is the time to deal with these issues. If not now, when? I've been hearing from my Republican friends for quite some time that it is a moral imperative for us to tackle our debt and our deficits in a serious way. I've been hearing from them that this is one of the things that's creating uncertainty and holding back investment on the part of the business community. And so what I've said to them is, let's go. And it is possible for us to construct a package that would be balanced, would share sacrifice, would involve both parties taking on their sacred cows, would involve some meaningful changes to Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid that would preserve the integrity of the programs and keep our sacred trust with our seniors, but make sure those programs were there for not just this generation, but for the next generation, that it is possible for us to bring in revenues in a way that does not impede our current recovery, but is fair and balanced. We have agreed to a series of spending cuts that will make the government leaner, meaner, more effective, more efficient, and give taxpayers a greater bang for their buck. That includes defense spending. That includes health spending. It includes some programs that I like very much, and we'd be nice to have, but that we can't afford right now. And if you look at this overall package, we could achieve a situation in which our deficits were at a manageable level and our debt levels were stabilized. And the economy as a whole, I think, would benefit from that. Moreover, I think it would give the American people enormous confidence that this town can actually do something once in a while, that we can defy the expectations that we're always thinking in terms of short-term politics in the next election, and every once in a while we break out of that and we do what's right for the country. So I continue to push congressional leaders for the largest possible deal. There's going to be resistance. There is, frankly, resistance on my side to do anything on entitlements. There is strong resistance on the Republican side to do anything on revenues. But if each side takes a maximalist position, if each side wants 100% of what its ideological predispositions are, then we can't get anything done. And I think the American people want to see something done. They feel a sense of urgency, both about the breakdown in our political process and also about the situation in our economy. So what I've said to the leaders is, bring back to me some ideas that you think can get the necessary number of votes in the House and in the Senate. I'm happy to consider all options, all alternatives that they're looking at. The things that I will not consider are a 30-day or a 60-day or a 90-day or 180-day temporary stopgap resolution to this problem. This is the United States of America, and we don't manage our affairs in 3-month increments. We don't risk U.S. default on our obligations because we can't put politics aside. So I've been very clear to them. We're going to resolve this, and we're going to resolve this for a reasonable period of time, and we're going to resolve it in a serious way. And my hope is that as a consequence of negotiations that take place today, tomorrow, the next day, and through next weekend if necessary, that we're going to come up with a plan that solves our short-term debt and deficit problems, avoids default, stabilizes the economy, and proves to the American people that we can actually get things done in this country and in this town. All right, with that, I'm going to take some questions, starting with Ben Phillip.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. Two quick topics. Given that you're running out of time, can you explain what is your plan for where these talks go if Republicans continue to oppose any tax increases, as they've adamantly said that they will? And secondly, on your point about no short-term stopgap measure, if it came down to that and Congress went that route, I know you're opposed to it, but would you veto it?
I will not sign a 30-day or a 60-day or a 90-day extension. That is just not an acceptable approach. And if we think it's going to be hard, if we think it's hard now, imagine how these guys are going to be thinking 6 months from now in the middle of election season when they're all up. It's not going to get easier. It's going to get harder. So we might as well do it now. Pull off the Band-Aid. Eat our peas. Now's the time to do it. If not now, when? We keep on talking about this stuff, and you know we have these high-minded pronouncements about how we've got to get control of the deficit and how we owe it to our children and our grandchildren. Well, let's step up. Let's do it. I'm prepared to do it. I'm prepared to take on significant heat from my party to get something done. And I expect the other side should be willing to do the same thing if they mean what they say, that this is important. And let me just, Ben, comment on this whole issue of tax increases, because there's been a lot of information floating around there. I want to be crystal clear. Nobody has talked about increasing taxes now. Nobody has talked about increasing taxes next year. What we have talked about is that starting in 2013, that we have gotten rid of some of these egregious loopholes that are benefiting corporate jet owners or oil companies at a time where they're making billions of dollars of profits. What we have said is, as part of a broader package, we should have revenues, and the best place to get those revenues are from folks like me who have been extraordinarily fortunate, and that millionaires and billionaires can afford to pay a little bit more, going back to the Bush tax rates. And what I've also said to the Republicans is, if you don't like that formulation, then I'm happy to work with you on tax reform that could potentially lower everybody's rates and broaden the base, as long as that package was sufficiently progressive so that we weren't balancing the budget on the backs of middle-class families and working-class families, and we weren't letting hedge fund managers or authors of best-selling books off the hook. That is a reasonable proposition. So when you hear folks saying, well, you know, the president shouldn't want, you know, massive job-killing tax increases when the economy's this weak, nobody's looking to raise taxes right now. We're talking about potentially 2013 and the out years. In fact, the only proposition that's out there about raising taxes next year would be if we don't renew the payroll tax cut that we passed in December, and I'm in favor of renewing it for next year as well. But there have been some Republicans who said we may not renew it. And if we don't renew that, then the $1,000 that's been going to a typical American family this year as a consequence of the tax cut that I worked with the Republicans and passed in December, that lapses. That could weaken the economy. So I have bent over backwards to work with the Republicans to try to come up with a formulation that doesn't require them to vote sometime in the next month to increase taxes. What I've said is, to identify a revenue package that makes sense, that is commensurate with the sacrifices we're asking other people to make, and then I'm happy to work with you to figure out how else we might do it.
Do you see any path to a deal if they don't budge on taxes?
I do not see a path to a deal if they don't budge, period. I mean, if the basic proposition is it's my way or the highway, then we're probably not going to get something done because we've got divided government. We've got Democrats controlling the Senate. We probably are going to need Democratic votes in the House for any package that could possibly pass. And so if, in fact, Mitch McConnell and John Boehner are sincere, and I believe they are, that they don't want to see the U.S. government default, then they're going to have to compromise just like Democrats are going to have to compromise. just like I have shown myself willing to compromise. Chip Reed.
Thank you, Mr. President. You said that everybody in the room is willing to do what they have to do, wants to get something done by August 2nd. But isn't the problem the people who aren't in the room, and in particular Republican presidential candidates, Republican Tea Partiers on the Hill, and the American public? The latest CBS News poll showed that only 24% of Americans said you should raise the debt limit to avoid an economic catastrophe. There are still 69% who oppose raising the debt limit. So isn't the problem that you and others have failed to convince the American people that we have a crisis here, and how are you going to change
that?
Well, let
me distinguish between professional politicians and the public at large. The public is not paying close attention to the ins and outs of how a Treasury auction goes. They shouldn't. They're worrying about their family. They're worrying about their jobs. They're worrying about their neighborhood. They've got a lot of other things on their plate. We're paid to worry about it. I think, depending on how you phrase the question, if you said to the American people, is it a good idea for the United States not to pay its bills and potentially create another recession that could throw millions of more people out of work, I feel pretty confident I can get a majority on my side on that one. And that's the fact. If we don't raise the debt ceiling and we see a crisis of confidence in the markets and suddenly interest rates are going up significantly, and everybody is paying higher interest rates on their car loans, on their mortgages, on their credit cards, and that's sucking up a whole bunch of additional money out of the pockets of American people, I promise you, they won't like that. Now, I will say that some of the professional politicians know better. And for them to say that we shouldn't be raising the debt ceiling is irresponsible. They know better. This is not something that I am making up. This is not something that Tim Geithner's making up. We're not out here trying to use this as a means of doing all these really tough political things. I'd rather be talking about stuff that everybody welcomes, like new programs or the NFL season getting resolved. Unfortunately, this is what's on our plate. It's before us right now, and we've got to deal with it. So what you're right about, I think, is that the leaders in the room here at a certain point have to step up and do the right thing, regardless of the voices in our respective parties that are trying to undermine that effort. I have a stake in John Boehner successfully persuading his caucus that this is the right thing to do, just like he has a stake in seeing me successfully persuading the Democratic Party that we should take on these problems that we've been talking about for too long but haven't been doing anything about.
Do you think he'll come back to the $4 trillion deal?
I think Speaker Boehner has been very sincere about trying to do something big. I think he'd like to do something big. His politics within his caucus are very difficult. You're right. And this is part of the problem with a political process where folks are rewarded for saying irresponsible things to win elections or obtain short-term political gain when we actually are in a position to try to do something hard. We haven't always laid the groundwork for it. And I think that it's going to take some work on his side, but look, it's also going to take some work on our side in order to get this thing done. I mean, the vast majority of Democrats on Capitol Hill would prefer not to have to do anything on entitlements, would prefer, frankly, not to have to do anything on some of these debt and deficit problems. And I'm sympathetic to their concerns because they're looking after folks who are already hurting and already vulnerable, and there are a lot of families out there and seniors who are dependent on some of these programs. And what I've tried to explain to them is, number one, if you look at the numbers, then Medicare, in particular, will run out of money, and we will not be able to sustain that program, no matter how much taxes go up. I mean, it's not an option for us to just sit by and do nothing. And if you're a progressive who cares about the integrity of Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and believes that it is part of what makes our country great, that we look after our seniors and we look after the most vulnerable, then we have an obligation to make sure that we make those changes that are required to make it sustainable over the long term. And if you're a progressive that cares about investments in Head Start and student loan programs and medical research and infrastructure, we're not going to be able to make progress on those areas if we haven't gotten our fiscal house in order. The argument I'm making to my party is the values we care about, making sure that everybody in this country has a shot at the American dream and everybody's out there with the opportunity to succeed if they work hard and live a responsible life, and that government has a role to play in providing some of that opportunity through things like student loans and making sure that our roads and highways and airports are functioning and making sure that we're investing in research and development for the high-tech jobs of the future. If you care about those things, then you've got to be interested in figuring out how do we pay for that in a responsible way. We're going to have a sales job. This is not pleasant. You know, it is hard to persuade people to do hard stuff that entails trimming benefits and increasing revenues. You know, but the reason we've got a problem right now is people keep on avoiding hard things. And I think now's the time for us to go ahead and take it on. Rich Wolf.
You keep talking about balance, shared sacrifice, but in the $4 trillion deal that you're talking about roughly, it seems that we're now at about 4-to-1 spending to taxes. We're talking about $800 billion in taxes roughly. That doesn't seem very fair to some Democrats. I'm wondering if you could clarify why we're at that level, and also if you could clarify your Social Security position. Would any of the money from Social Security, even from just change CPI, go toward the deficit as opposed to back into the trust fund?
With respect to Social Security is not the source of our deficit problems. Social Security, if it is part of a package, would be an issue of how do we make sure Social Security extends its life and is strengthened. So the reason to do Social Security is to strengthen Social Security to make sure that those benefits are there for seniors in the out years. The reason to include that potentially in this package is if you're going to take a bunch of tough votes, you might as well do it now, as opposed to trying to muster up the political will to get something done further down in the future. With respect to a balanced package, is the package that we're talking about exactly what I would want? No. I might want more revenues and fewer cuts to programs that benefit middle-class families that are trying to send their kids to college or benefit all of us because we're investing more in medical research. I make no claims that somehow the position that Speaker Boehner and I discussed reflects 100% of what I want. But that's the point. My point is that I'm willing to move in their direction in order to get something done. And that's what compromise entails. We have a system of government in which everybody's got to give a little bit. Now, what I will say is that the revenue components that we've discussed would be significant and would target folks who can most afford it. And if we don't do any revenue, because you may hear the argument that why not just go ahead and do all the cuts and we can debate the revenue issues in the election, right? You'll hear that from some Republicans. The problem is that if you don't do the revenues, then to get the same amount of savings, you've got to have more cuts, which means that it's seniors or it's poor kids or it's medical researchers or it's our infrastructure that suffers. And it, you know, I do not want and I will not accept a deal in which I am asked to do nothing. In fact, I'm able to keep hundreds of thousands of dollars in additional income that I don't need, while a parent out there who's struggling to figure out how to send their kid to college suddenly finds that they've got a couple thousand dollars less in grants or student loans. That's what the revenue debate's about. It's not because I want to raise revenues for the for the sake of raising revenues, or I've got some grand ambition to create a bigger government. It's because if we're going to actually solve the problem, there are a finite number of ways to do it. And if you don't have revenues, it means you are putting more of a burden on the people who can least afford it. And that's not fair. I think the American people agree with me on that. Sam Stein.
Thank you, Mr. President. With unemployment now at 9.2%, and a large chunk of those lost jobs coming from the public sector, is now really a good time to cut trillions of dollars in spending? How will this bill create jobs? And then to piggyback on the Social Security question, what do you say to members of your own party who say it doesn't contribute to the deficit? Let's consider it, but not in the context of this case.
Our biggest priority as an administration is getting the economy back on track and putting people back to work. Now, you know, without relitigating the past, I am absolutely convinced, and the vast majority of economists are convinced, that the steps we took in the Recovery Act saved millions of people their jobs or created a whole bunch of jobs. And part of the evidence of that is, as you see what happens with the Recovery Act phasing out. You know, when I came into office and budgets were hemorrhaging at the state level, part of the Recovery Act was giving states help so they wouldn't have to lay off teachers, police officers, firefighters. As we've seen that federal support for states diminish, you've seen the biggest job losses in the public sector, teachers, police officers, firefighters losing their jobs. So my strong preference would be for us to figure out ways that we can continue to provide help across the board. But I'm operating within some political constraints here, because whatever I do has to go through the House of Representatives. What that means then is that among the options that are available to us is, for example, the payroll tax cut, which might not be exactly the kind of program that I would design in order to boost employment, but does make a difference because it puts money in the pockets of people who are then spending it at businesses, large and small. That gives them more customers, increases demand, and it gives businesses a greater incentive to hire. And that would be, for example, a component of this overall package. Unemployment benefits. Again, puts money in the pockets of folks who are out there, you know, knocking on doors trying to find a job every day, giving them those resources. That puts more money into the economy, and that potentially improves the climate for businesses to want to hire. As part of a component of a deal, I think it's very important for us to look at what are the steps we can take short term in order to put folks back to work. I am not somebody who believes that just because we solve the deficit and debt problems short term, medium term, or long term, that that automatically solves the unemployment problem. I think we're still going to have to do a bunch of stuff, including, for example, trade deals that are before Congress right now that could add tens of thousands of jobs. Republicans gave me this list at the beginning of this year as a priority, something that they thought they could do. Now I'm ready to do it, and so far we haven't gotten the kind of movement that I would have expected. We've got the potential to create an infrastructure bank that could put construction workers to work right now, rebuilding our roads and our bridges and our vital infrastructure all across the country. So those are still areas where I think we can make enormous progress. I do think that if the country as a whole sees Washington act responsibly, compromises being made, the deficit and debt being dealt with for 10, 15, 20 years, that will help with businesses feeling more confident about aggressively investing in this country, foreign investors saying America's got its act together and are willing to invest. And so it can have a positive impact in overall growth and employment. It's not the only solution. We're still going to have a strong jobs agenda, but it is part of a solution. I might add, it is the primary solution that the Republicans have offered when it comes to jobs. They keep on going out there and saying, you know, Mr. President, what are you doing about jobs? And when you ask them, well, what would you do? We've got to get government spending under control, and we've got to get our deficits under control. So I say, okay, let's go. Where are they? I mean, this is what they claim would be the single biggest boost to business certainty and confidence. So what's the holdup? With respect to Social Security, as I indicated earlier, making changes to these programs is so difficult that this may be an opportunity for us to go ahead and do something smart that strengthens Social Security and gives not just this generation but future generations the opportunity to say this thing's going to be in there for the long haul. Now, that may not be possible. And you're absolutely right that, as I said, Social Security is not the primary driver of our long-term deficits and debt. On the other hand, we do want to make sure that Social Security is going to be there for next generations. And if there is a reasonable deal to be had on it, it is one that I'm willing to pursue.
With respect to Social Security, like raising the retirement age, means testing, are those too big a chunk to budget?
I'm probably not going to get into the details, Sam, right now of negotiations. I might enjoy negotiating with you, but I don't know how much juice you've got in the Republican caucus. That's what I figure. All right. Leslie Clark.
Thank you, President. There you go. You've talked to economists. You've said that economists have agreed that a deal needs to be made. Have you worked with U.S. business leaders at all to lobby Congress to raise the debt ceiling? And if so, who are you talking to?
I have spoken extensively to business leaders. And I'll be honest with you. I think that business leaders in the abstract want to see a resolution to this problem. What I found is that they are somewhat hesitant to weigh in on some of these issues, even if they're willing to say something privately to me, partly because they've got a whole bunch of business pending before Congress, and they don't want to make anybody mad. This is a problem of our politics and our politicians, but it's not exclusively a problem of our politics and our politicians. I mean, the business community is a lot like everybody else, which is we want to cut everybody else's stuff, and we want to keep our stuff. We want to cut our taxes, but if you want to raise revenue with somebody else's taxes, that's okay. And that kind of mindset is why we never get the problem solved. There have been business leaders like Warren Buffett who I think have spoken out forcefully on this issue. I think some of the folks who participated in the Bowles-Simpson Commission made very clear that they would agree to a balanced approach, even if it meant for them individually that they were seeing slightly higher taxes on their income, given that they're, I think the average CEO, if I'm not mistaken, saw a 23% raise this past year, while the average worker saw a 0 to 1% raise last year. So I think that there are a lot of well-meaning business people out there who recognize the need to make something happen. But I think that they've been hesitant to be as straightforward as I'd like when it says this is what a balanced package means. It means that we've got some spending cuts. It means that we've got some increased revenue. And it means that we're taking on some of the drivers of our long-term debt and deficits.
And can you say, as the clock ticks down, whether or not the administration is working?
I'm sorry.
Can you say, as the clock ticks down, whether or not the administration is working on any sort of contingency plans if things don't happen by August 2nd?
We are going to get this done by August 2nd. George Condon.
Mr. President, to follow on Chip's question, you said that the Speaker faces tough politics in his caucus. Do you have complete confidence that he can deliver the votes on anything that he agrees to? Is he in control of his caucus?
You know, that's a question for the Speaker, not a question for me. My experience with John Boehner is has been good. I think he's a good man who wants to do right by the country. I think that it's a as Chip alluded to, the politics that swept him into the speakership were good for a midterm election. They're tough for governing. And you know, part of what the Republican caucus generally needs to recognize is that American democracy works when people listen to each other, we're willing to give each other the benefit of the doubt. We assume the patriotism and good intentions of the other side, and we're willing to make some sensible compromises to solve big problems. And I think that there are members of that caucus who haven't fully arrived at that realization yet.
So your confidence in him wasn't shaken by him walking away from the big deal he said he wanted?
You know, these things are a tough process, and look, in fairness, a big deal would require a lot of work on the part of Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi and myself to bring Democrats along. But the point is if everybody gets in the boat at the same time, it doesn't tip over. I think that was Bob Dole's famous comment after striking a deal with the president and Mr. Gingrich back in the 90s. And that is always the case when it comes to difficult but important tasks like this. All right. Last question, April Ryan.
Mr. President, hi. I want to revisit the issue of sacrifice. Mm-hmm. In 2009, you said that expect the worst to come. We have not seen the worst yet. And now with these budget cuts looming, you have minorities, the poor, the elderly, as well as people who are scared of losing jobs. Fearful. And also, what say you about Congressman Shaka Fatah's bill, the Debt Free America Act? Do you support that one, or are you supporting the Republican bill that's similar to his, modeled after Congressman Fatah's bill?
Well, I'm not going to comment on a particular bill right now. Let me speak to the broader point that you're asking about, April. This recession has been hard on everybody. But obviously, it's harder on folks who've got less. And the thing that I am obsessed with and have been since I came into office is all those families out there who are doing the right thing every single day, who are looking after their families, who are just struggling to keep up and just feel like they're falling behind no matter how hard they work. I got a letter this past week from a woman who her husband had lost his job, had you know, pounded the pavement, finally found a job. They felt like things were stabilizing for a few months. 6 months later, he lost the second job. Now they're back looking again and trying to figure out how are they ever going to make ends meet. And they're just you know, hundreds of thousands of folks out there who really have seen as tough a economy as we've seen in our lifetimes. Now, we took very aggressive steps when I first came into office to yank the economy out of a potential Great Depression and stabilize it. And we were largely successful in stabilizing it, but we stabilized it at a level where unemployment is still too high and the economy is not growing fast enough to make up for all the jobs that were lost before I took office and the few months after I took office. So this unemployment rate has been really stubborn. There are a couple of ways that we can solve that. Number one is to make sure that the overall economy is growing. And so we have continued to take a series of steps to make sure that there's money in people's pockets, that they can go out there and spend. That's what these payroll tax cuts were about. We've taken a number of steps to make sure that businesses are willing to invest. And that's what the small business tax cuts and some of the tax breaks for companies that are willing to invest in plants and equipment and zero capital gains for small businesses. That's what that was all about, was giving businesses more incentive to invest. We have worked to make sure that the training programs that are out there for folks who are having to shift from jobs that may not exist anymore so that they can get the training they need for the jobs that do exist, that those are improved and sharpened. We have put forward a series of proposals to make sure that regulations that may be unnecessary and are hampering some businesses from investing, that we are examining all of those for their costs and their benefits. And if they are not providing the kind of benefits in terms of the public health and clean air and clean water and worker safety that have been promised, then we should get rid of some of those regulations. So we've been looking at the whole menu of steps that can be taken. We are now in a situation where, because the economy has moved slower than we wanted, because of the deficits and debt that result from the recession and the crisis, that you know, taking an approach that costs trillions of dollars is not an option. We don't have that kind of money right now. What we can do is to solve this underlying debt and deficit problem for a long period of time so that then we can get back to having a conversation about, all right, since we now have solved this problem, that's not no longer what's hampering economic growth. That's not feeding business uncertainty. Everybody feels that the ground is stable under our feet. Are there some strategies that we could pursue that would really focus on some targeted job growth? Infrastructure being a primary example. I mean, the infrastructure bank that we've proposed is relatively small. But could we imagine a project where we're rebuilding roads and bridges and ports and schools and broadband lines and smart grids and taking all those construction workers and putting them to work right now? I can imagine a very aggressive program like that that I think the American people would rally around and would be good for the economy, not just next year or the year after, but for the next 20 or 30 years. But we can't even have that conversation if people feel as if we don't have our fiscal house in order. Right? So the idea here is let's act now, let's get this problem off the table, and then with some firm footing, with a solid fiscal situation, we will then be in a position to make the kind of investments that I think are going to be necessary to win the future. So this is not a right or left conservative liberal situation. This is how do we operate in a smart way, understanding that we've got some short-term challenges and some long-term challenges. If we can solve some of those long-term challenges, that frees up some of our energies to be able to deal with some of these short-term ones as well. All right? Thank you very much, everybody.
President Obama wrapping up a news conference in the Brady briefing room at the White House, where he opened by saying there is good news on the deficit reduction talks as part of the effort to raise the debt ceiling. All the leaders involved in these discussions, the Big Eight, as they're known, that is the leaders, the two top leaders from each party in both houses of Congress, the president, of course, and the vice president are involved, says all those leaders believe it is not acceptable not to raise the debt ceiling. The full faith and credit of the United States, he says, is involved. Nevertheless, there is much work to do, and he had very little other progress to report, or very little other agreement. Now is the time, he said, if not now, when? And he also said it is time for both parties to compromise. I'm prepared to take on significant heat from my party, he said, to get this done. I expect the same from Republicans, though at another point he said, I do not see a path to a deal if they don't budge, period. With me here in the studio is NPR's national political correspondent, Mara Liasson. Mara, the president laid out his priorities as we have heard them in the past. He did appeal to Republicans to say, look, you cannot expect 100% of everything you want.
He's been saying that for quite some time. And obviously, the message, part of the political message today is he wants to remind voters, particularly independent voters, that he's the guy who ran in 2008 to bridge differences, to be willing to compromise, to make Washington work again. He hasn't been able to do that here. But he kept on saying that over and over again. I'm prepared to take significant heat from my party on these issues like Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security. The other party should do the same, which they aren't. And that's been the problem. That's the impasse. He said that I have a stake in John Boehner successfully convincing his caucus to move. He has a stake in me doing the same thing. He did say something that I thought really stuck out. He said, we both want to do something big and something that's very difficult. We haven't always laid the groundwork for it. I think that that's a failure of the president and possibly the speaker. Doing what they were talking about, which is tax reform coupled to all these other things, is huge. And they kind of sprung it on everyone. You know, it's not like they've been out campaigning for this for a while. I mean, you could have had the Barack Obama, John Boehner show going around and explaining why this is so important, but they didn't. But I do think he explained very articulately what is the impasse, but he didn't explain how it's going to get broken.
Because there is very little agreement, David Wellna up on Capitol Hill, very little agreement as to the path forward if Democrats, and he specifically made an appeal to progressives in his own party saying, look, if you want programs like Head Start, we have to get our fiscal house in order. We do need to make cuts to go along. And yes, this is not everything I would like in a package, but that's the deal we have to make.
Right. He said, I'm willing to take some heat. And it's clear that he is pushing a lot of the more progressive Democrats in his caucus to go along with him in such a deal. But he also, I think, when he talked about taxes, I think he made it very clear that he is not going to accept any kind of a deal that does not include increased tax revenues. And that is something that would appease some of his critics from the left. I think he made it clear that he wasn't willing to sign something that didn't include revenue increases. So he pretty much laid down a bright line about where he would not go any further if there aren't revenue increases.
The president also said that he would not sign any stopgap agreement, any 30, 60, 90, 120-day agreement that might extend the debt ceiling for a short period of time, that he specifically ruled out. You're listening to special coverage from NPR News.
Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey. We're at the mid-session point of this trading day. Wheat futures and corn futures are definitely on the defensive. While we're seeing a mixed market in the soybean complex, U.S. grain futures are falling as a result of a rising dollar due to worries about the economic growth in this country as well as across the pond in Europe. A pullback from last week's big weekly gains come before the U.S. Department of Agriculture's monthly supply and demand report that's due out tomorrow morning.